Blog Talk Radio.
Zach, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, you come in at a great time. I was just teasing up how teams are starting to return to the shop and how this potential maybe new schedule is being tossed around. You and I discussed earlier, what are your takes, starting with the teams returning to the shop? You obviously have a lot of friends in the industry. What are you hearing? What are some of the concerns? What are some of the things they're saying? Kind of give us your perspective in on that.
So one thing that we need to make clear is, and if you said it, I might have missed it by pure accident, was that the governor of North Carolina has officially stated that NASCAR workers are quote-unquote essential workers, which is giving them the ability to go to the shops. So with that being said, there is a lot of teams that are going back. There's some that aren't. It's one of these weird things where there's some teams who took the initial time when they canceled the Atlanta race to get trucks ready for or get equipment ready for other racetracks. For instance, Nice Motorsports, a few friends that work there, took the time to get some really good equipment ready for, you know, short track, intermediate. The only thing they really got to do is wrap it and put a and swap out the transmission if they really have to, and a driver's seat depending on who's going to be piloting it. So it's one of these things where, first off, it's great to hear that my friends get to go back to work and work on the cars, but there's been some hijinks with this as well. Well, I wouldn't say hijinks by, like, team owners or drivers or such, but one thing I shared with Brady earlier was Gillen Crosley Racing had some additions to the team. Some raccoons snuck into their haulers, so that's one thing now that I'm starting to worry is, like, how many haulers or how many people have now had or how many teams now have extra livestock in their haulers or in their shops right now.
Oh, exactly. And if you didn't quite catch it, folks, on social media, DTR Crosley shared a video of raccoons that had gotten into some of their equipment, and Zach had shown me this. They'd gotten into everything from the team transporters to some maybe back-end storage where they keep banners and stuff, so like Zach said, you just don't know what unexpected challenges the teams are facing. But the big thing going forward, and Zach kind of alluded to it, there's a bunch of cars already prepared for races at Atlanta, Homestead, Texas. And primarily these were the cars under NASCAR's 550-horsepower high downforce package. And so if you look at these upcoming races that are tentatively races that are scheduled for May, the thing that they all have in common is they all – minus Darlington utilized, I think, no, Darlington as well. They all utilized that same race package, minus Martinsville and Bristol, which are way, way later on in May. And so they're able to use, like Zach said, cars that were already prepared, maybe with just some minor tweaks that can easily be transported without having a lot of people to work on them. That, and also if you look at their proximity to the North Carolina region where a lot of these teams are based, it's no coincidence that they're eyeing South Carolina's Darlington Raceway and obviously North Carolina's Charlotte Raceway for being the two first tracks that they're taking a look at, and then obviously sweeping through Virginia with Martinsville, Tennessee with Bristol, Georgia with Atlanta, and Homestead in Florida, Miami. So, you know, kind of keeping it in that southeastern region. And I feel like there's no coincidence there. So definitely going to have to keep an eye on that. But with that major news story broke, it's a perfect time, but I think
now, hold on.
My co-host.
Before any major news story breaks, Dr. John's back. I had to restart my computer. Sorry about that. I can't wait to hear
John's
the news
here.
Story. Yep, I'm here.
Perfect. Well, joining me from the always sunny North Carolina, we've got first in Studio G, Zach Beechler, who you just heard a minute ago. Zach, say hello.
Well, South Carolina, close, but okay. Yeah, hello.
Yeah, we're
hello.
In South Carolina.
Oh, South Carolina. Well, you know, Carolina. I'm learning my geographies, and there's the man who would probably put me straight on my geographies, Dr. John. How are we doing today?
We're doing just great. Been all over the country, and Myrtle Beach is opening tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, drive down to Myrtle Beach. It's open. No lifeguards.
It's open, but is it a good idea? That's going to be the question we're going to keep an eye on over these next weeks, and that's what the drivers and teams and everyone involved with the situation on reopening the NASCAR season is keeping an eye on. So I don't know. There's a lot to digest, and it's hard to believe it's only been 1 week since we were all back in studio.
Well, all I got to say is this.
Golly.
You said, is it a good idea? Heck yes, it's a good idea. You know what? We're going to live with coronavirus for the rest of our lives, just like we have the flu. So get it and get out. I already had it 8 weeks ago. Get it. Earth? Get out and have a great time.
Wait a minute. What?
I already had coronavirus. So, heck, what can I say?
but yeah, so what Brady was talking about, you know, a lot of this stuff is – so there's a quote-unquote schedule floating around, and there's no viable resource. There's no source that says this is what NASCAR is in. This is that.
Actually, Auto Week is the attributed source being attributed to leaking out the schedule. No one officially from the sport, but the official leak is coming from Auto Week.
That's what I'm saying. There's no, like, NASCAR hasn't said, hey, this or that or this. So, you know, it does. But what you said was correct. You know, it makes sense for a lot of these races in the next few weeks to be, you know, in Darlington, in Atlanta, in Charlotte, because, you know, it's so close that if teams need to do some major overhauls, let's say, you know, the Darlington car that they ran 1 week and they're running it the next week gets wrecked and it's a great car, they could take it back to Charlotte, which is less than 4 hours away, to either get the cosmetic damage fixed, to get a new wrap on it, or do whatever. In fact, you know, this might be a thing where some teams, if the cars are in great condition, they might just stay camped there in Darlington, even though it's only 4 hours away, and do a lot of work, kind of like what we saw on the West Coast Swing, where a lot of teams stayed in Vegas for 3 weeks straight to do a lot of work and to do a lot of racing stuff. So I am interested to see, because one on there that was interesting that caught my eye was Darlington, and it said 301. The only race I could think of that they would change or take away is New Hampshire, because it's the only race that has that odd little number, the 301 race. So that was an interesting one to see from a fan's perspective.
Oh, yeah. No, and we're definitely going to keep a close eye on this situation. As states like Iowa, where I'm at, and the South Carolina and North Carolina region where you guys are at, are starting to slowly reel back sanctions, we're going to know right quickly if we're okay and get the green light to start reopening the country, or if maybe things are a little too soon. And the way this virus has been moving, we're going to get those answers soon. So definitely by next week's podcast, we'll have more concrete updates for you as we get closer and closer to these supposed return dates. But one story of interest before we get to some other late breaking news that's come out over the last couple of days, kind of more of a positive news story, and I know there's been a lot going around about how different teams are finding ways to utilize their shops to make PPE gear and giving back and donating to try and help out through the COVID virus. And one news story kind of related to that actually comes from one of NASCAR's most legendary teams with Richard Childress Racing, a team of 50 plus years in NASCAR. They are kind of now beginning the early stages of auctioning off different memorabilia and exclusive hard-to-find items from their own museum and personal collections to try and raise money to help benefit those around them suffering from either loss of income, you know, housing difficulties, everything related to the COVID outbreak. Including one of the items that's probably the most of note is an original number three Chevrolet actually raced by Dale Earnhardt in one of the races back in the late 90s. It's impeccably preserved, including one of the original engines. And this is the first time that Childress has ever parted with an original Earnhardt car from his collection. So that in and of itself is fascinating. But the legendary team owner is quoted as saying, "I've grown my personal collection of memorabilia throughout my career in NASCAR and have enjoyed each of these items, but it's time to open it up to collectors and use the proceeds to help much-needed causes during this unique time in history. From the Earnhardt years to the Harvick years to our current drivers and beyond, there are items in this collection that will appeal to a variety of collectors. And it's so special to me to be able to share these exclusive items and give back to America at this time. All proceeds will benefit charities and organizations who need our help right now to fight COVID-19. End quote on that. So, Zach, I'm going to kind of bring you into the conversation here. You have your ear right down to the ground. You're right around these teams. So you're seeing these efforts, honestly, probably in real time. But what do these efforts really do for the communities that are benefit around them? And then kind of going a little more in depth on this, how cool would it be to own an original Earnhardt number three?
So one big thing that I don't think a lot of people understand is, you know, some, a lot of these crews, some are still getting paid for the time that they're not working, whether it is through unemployment or whether it's through, you know, like NBN Motorsports, Kyle Long is loaning out money to, is giving out money to his members of his team who he had to lay off and hopes that he can get a small loan or something for the from the government to help bail him out because he didn't want, you know, his employees and his team to not just go under but not have food for the table or food for the families or anything. There's a lot of – there's some people who are taking this in stride and having a new hobby. Some are taking this with, you know, kind of like me going insane with nothing else to do. But it definitely does help because – it still gives them that feel of, okay, I still have a job and they're helping, you know, with whatever I need. And that's a big thing because there's some people, like, for instance, pit crews. Some pit crews work for teams, like RCR has their own crew, Hendrick, Stuart Haas, you know, all their crews are with them all year round. But then there's some, like, agencies that have their own pit school that, you know, will you rent a pit crew for a race, and that's how a lot of teams will do that. Some lower end teams and some teams like in Xfinity or even in the truck series, Thor Motorsports goes through an agency most a lot of times. So that's a big hit for a lot of them because some of them would be doing 2-3 races a weekend and making anywhere between $600 to $1,500 depending on how the race went. So it definitely is a cool thing to see. And a cool thing to hear is like, yeah, my team, not my boss, my team is getting help. And my team is happy that they get to keep their dream job, keep what they love going. So I do love that. And one thing, too, that is really cool about this thing that Richard Childress is doing, it's some people are thinking, oh, it's like a flag or this or that. No, what he's donating besides the actual car, which I would love to take that around Daytona, Martinsville, any track. That would be fantastic because that's a piece of racing history that hardly ever comes up. There are some that come up, but there's no background behind it. There's no idea when it could have been raced or if it was a show car, if it was a backup car. But that would be great. But what the great thing about what Childress is doing, he's donating actual, you know, he's donating diecast is a big one that's on there. But they're all prototypes for the most part. They're all cars that, you know, we're pre-productions, and a lot of collectors, including myself, are sought after. I have a couple prototypes myself, and they are not easy to come by, and they're not cheap. And the cool thing is that there's a lot of people bidding on these to really get money coming into people. And I know some people are like, well, you know, that's fine and dandy, but why did he have these in the first place? And it's just like any other collector. You have your passion, you have your heart in something, you're going to collect it, whether it's a car that weighs 5 pounds or a car that weighs 3,500 pounds. You're going to want it. So it is very cool to see. And there's a lot of cool cars on there that if I had money, I'd put a bid in or two or 12, but I'm not. So I'm keeping my eye off eBay right now.
Exactly. Well, very well put on that, Zach. And if you're interested in looking into these items for yourself or your own collection, you can check out some of the more knick-knack items and more memorabilia-esque items at his eBay store at ebay.com/Richard Childress Racing Collection. And for anyone interested in buying the actual Dale Earnhardt race car, you should contact RCR directly. I imagine they have a phone number you can contact on their website. So that's a pretty interesting story there. But one of the more unique stories that's kind of come out as we're getting closer, maybe returning to racing right around May, is, you know, kind of tidying up some of the bigger driver vacancies that have kind of popped up in 2020. We're going to start with probably the most surprising of the driver announcements. Matt Kenseth has been tapped to drive the number 42 for Chip Ganassi Racing for the rest of the season. The 2003 championship has come out of retirement to take over the ride that was vacated when Kyle Larson was let go for his profanity used in an online race at the Monza exhibition 2 weeks ago. This also marks a reunion of sorts for Matt Kenseth and former teammate Kurt Busch, the only two drivers to win for the legendary team owner Jack Roush for a championship in NASCAR's Premier Division. So a really good pairing right there. And Chip Ganassi has been a team that's kind of been surging in later seasons, really under the guidance of Kyle Larson, but last year especially with the added addition of Kurt Busch. So, Zach, I want you to start off here talking about kind of what the immediate reaction you're hearing around the garage area and what the overall buzz is on social media about how people are feeling about the Wisconsin native coming back to full-time racing.
So I'll start with the buzz because that's a big one. So a lot of people are it's a weird thing because at first everyone thought, and there was no, you know, concrete evidence of this, everyone thought Ross Chastain would run that car. Now, he wouldn't run for a championship because he's really dedicated to running for a championship in the Xfinity. We've seen that. We've heard that. And because he has RCR affiliate equipment, you know, running for Colleague Racing, he's more dedicated to that. It's kind of like last year when, you know, he had a fantastic ride with Jim Ganassi Racing, and that folded. So then he floated between Colleague Racing and Johnny Davis Motorsports on, you know, maybe doing the Xfinity Championship. And then fast forward to he wins a truck race. He's like, okay, let me stay in Nice because he was running full-time with Nice because the schedule was working with him. And he was able to run for a championship. He switched his points and was able to go all the way to the championship four, missed out, but he had one hell of a run. So there was speculation that he would do it, and there was speculation he wouldn't do it. Nothing came out of anywhere. And it was interesting because we never heard Matt Kenseth. In fact, I have a couple people that are close to the organization that even said, I had no clue. There was no this or that. It was one of the things that was like, it came out of the blue, and I texted a buddy. He's like, cool, what's up? So you guys got Kenseth. He goes, dude, I just found out myself. I'm like, what? So the buzz is, it's one of these things that's up in the air because people are like, oh, Chip Ganassi should buy out Ross's contract and put him in it, blah, blah, blah. And there's people like, why would he bring Kenseth in? He's 40-some years old. And one thing that Brady pointed out, and I had heard quite a bit, was, you know, Chip wants a championship for his sponsors. And that's true. Anytime you have a sponsor, you want them to have the opportunity to win a championship. Now, there are some sponsors who won't have, you know, the money like Credit One, McDonald's will be able to put out, and they understand that. You know, they might go with a budget team like MBM Motorsports, Timmy Hill Motorsports, BJ McLeod, something like that, to where they can afford to, you know, have the advertising, have a cool weekend too. But the big thing is that Kenseth is not just a champion, but he's a race winner up until the end. His last full-time season was with Joe Gibbs Racing in the number 19 that the next season Eric Jones would take over.
20.
And he got a win. He got a win at Phoenix, which was great for him. But he, you know, didn't go on to win the championship, and he misses that. But he still was competitive, and he still was late next year when Trevor Bayne was let go from Roush, and steps up Matt Kenseth filling in for races here and there. So it's one of those things where he competed well for everything that he had, but he also was one of these guys that I feel even at age 41, I believe, he can compete. It's just going to be one of those things where he's had great equipment for a majority of his career. Do not get me wrong. It's one of those things of getting back into the swing. The last time he raced was 2018, I believe.
2018, yeah, 2018. The Homestead Finale, where he racked up a top 10.
So he's been off for a year from the Cup side. He has been doing some late model stuff, doing some more stuff with his family. So I'm hyped for it. I've, you know, seen Kenseth run, and I have a 20 door in my storage unit that I want to get signed by him. So I might be sneaking into a race or two if I can.
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, we're going to pick up more about Kenseth here in a minute. But like you said, it was definitely a smart move by Ganassi. If they're looking to run for a championship, Kenseth is a championship caliber driver. He may not win a bunch of races, but he puts up solid results. He's consistent, and that's ultimately what wins championships. And if you look at his last few seasons, especially the Gibbs era, his last few years, I believe that's five seasons right there, he has finishes in the championship points at 2nd, 7th, 15th, which an asterisk on that 15th, that's the 2015 season where he was part of two races for Wreck and Logano, so he probably would have been higher that season. But after that, he rebounded for a 5th in 2016, and a 7th in 2017, his last full-time season. So he's got the caliber and the pedigree, and we're going to touch about that here in just a minute, but I want to put a pin mark there because there was another late-breaking story that came out in the last couple days, similar to almost the left-field nature of the Kenseth announcement, but Ryan Newman went from Sunday announcing that he intends to go back to full-time racing to Monday NASCAR medically clearing him to return to the Roush Fenway number 6 Ford Mustang. So it's hard to believe, but we're only a few short months removed away from that scary, almost life-altering crash that he went through at Daytona. But now he has been medically cleared by the sport and by leading doctors, and he's primed and ready to return back to that 6 team. So what a announcement, and honestly a breath of relief right there for that whole entire family to know that he's going to be back up and going back to doing what he loved. And that also ties into where we're going to bring these two stories together. NASCAR also granted a championship waiver for both Ryan Newman and Matt Kenseth. And the whole reason this is necessary is when NASCAR instituted the playoff format that we now know back in 2014, they made it so that any driver looking to qualify for the postseason has to compete in all 36 events. They have granted waivers in the past, most notably with Kyle Busch in 2015 when he broke a couple legs in an Xfinity race and missed the subsequent starting 9 races in 2015. So this is not really unnecessarily unprecedented. So they are granting a waiver for Ryan Newman for missing 3 of the first 4 races, and then obviously Matt Kenseth for not starting the first 4. So provided that they can either race their way high enough into points to qualify in the top 16 or be in the top 30 in points and get a win sometime in the regular season, you may see these early 2000s veterans finally breaking in and maybe getting a shot at stealing some championship thunder where maybe people didn't think they had a shot just a few weeks ago. So, Zach, I'll have you pick it up right here. What's been the buzz about Newman's return? Was any real rumblings kind of leading up to this? And what is the overall reaction of people seeing the Rocket Man maybe going back to competition?
Well, one big thing that kind of threw people off was the fact that he made this announcement on Sunday. Now, obviously, we're happy to hear that, but he made the announcement that I'll be back to race. A lot of people were misconstruing that, saying, he got cleared. Well, and I actually had to correct some people. I was like, whoa, back her down. NASCAR, and that's the thing, is NASCAR has not cleared him. NASCAR's doctors have not cleared him. Now, I'm not saying that they haven't, you know, already done the, you know, at that moment, NASCAR hadn't done the thing of, like, saying, hey, you know, we're going to wait to make an announcement. But that was the thing that threw me off, was he made the announcement on Sunday. Yesterday, he said, NASCAR said, Ryan Newman is officially cleared. He can race, blah, blah, blah. Great, cool. Kind of odd that you made the announcement before NASCAR could even say yes or no, because what if something were to happen that, oh, he's not cleared just yet. We got a couple hurdles. But it's great to hear both that it's good to hear, one, that he's feeling great and he's doing great. And I think that that's a great thing for not just him, but for the sport, to see someone that, you know, called the Rocket Man, someone that truly is an incredible human being, not just a great driver, but a very nice man and a very incredible guy who loves the sport as much as he loves nature and loves preserving stuff. It's, you know, everyone's saying the same thing. We're glad to have him, glad to have him back. We're glad to have him back at the track at some point. The big thing, though, is that waiver. So, like you said, NASCAR will grant these for certain things. So One of them is injury or ailment. So, for instance, if a driver misses a race because, you know, they have the flu and NASCAR says you're not allowed to go out there because it's a health concern, NASCAR gives them a waiver. Hey, yeah, you're fine. When this first got introduced, there was talks that someone had said, like, well, a driver could, you know, if they race at a – if there's a track that he doesn't like to race at, he could just say, oh, I have a flu, cough, cough. No, NASCAR will grant these waivers if you're legitimately sick. It's not like, oh, I've got a cough, like, you know, going to school. I'm like, oh, I got a fever, and it's like 98.9, you know. So it's great to hear that he's going to be eligible if he races his way in or gets the point. So that's the big thing is what can they do? Obviously, a win and you're in is going to be a guaranteed because they just need to climb up to 35th in points to qualify 30th. For the – I'm sorry?
30th in points. 35th is 30th. The old rules.
That's right, 30th in points, which still is not entirely difficult. We're still really early on in the season. We've only gotten 4 races in. So going from, you know, Newman does have some points. He can climb up the ladder to 30th. And in all reality, they could both climb in to the top 16 if they could race really good, if they could race really well, if they could keep getting top 5 and top 10 finishes. They could, possibly even get up there without getting a win. It's not like the instance with Kyle Busch, who had a life-changing injury of breaking both his legs at Daytona and getting that waiver and having to really pound it out. Coming back from surgery and rehabilitation, he got his first win of the year at Indy, which that did not solid him into the race championship because he didn't have the points required just yet. So it's going to be great to see what they can do. It's going to be really cool to see what Matt Kenseth could do because that's going to be something that everyone's going to keep an eye on because we haven't heard the name Kenseth in for over a year now. And it's going to be interesting to see, hey, what can you do? Can you still race? Are you still have talent? Do you still, are you still able to wheel that thing around? I think one great race that we'll have to look forward to will be Phoenix. Now, if he makes the final, I mean, if he can make it into the 16, I feel like if he can make it all the way to the top 8, if we get to Phoenix, he'll win Phoenix and be in for a championship 4.
And one thing of note here with the 2020 season, like Zach said, we've only got 4 races in, so the points really haven't gotten that spread out. And if you look at the 2020 tally as they sit, ending after the last race at Phoenix, Ryan Newman is still ranked 29th in points, only 128 back of the leader, and only 54 back of Kurt Busch in 16. So Ryan Newman is so not out of this by any stretch of the imagination. If he can get on a good run early when he gets back to racing in that 6 car, he's back in the thick of it without any problem at all. It's going to be a little bit tougher of a climb for Matt Kenseth because right now the lowest in points is Garrett Smithy with 7 accumulated points. So he's got a long way to go to try and rack up some points. But Garrett Smithy with his 7-point total that he's accumulated, he's only 157 out of the lead. So this is not a super steep Mount Everest for either driver to climb. The biggest thing going to be facing both of them as they get back behind the wheel is going to be Ryan Newman just adjusting to things, making sure nothing feels out of tune, out of sync with what he's normally used to dealing with in the race car, and just getting through whatever emotions come up or whatever mental blockages that he might have to deal with just coming back from a crash of that magnitude. So that's the thing we're going to have to keep an eye on with the number 6 team. But with that number 42 team, they face a whole different uphill battle. It's not that the team isn't good, and it's not that the driver isn't good, but they've not worked together. They've not been put into a scenario where they've had a chance to build any chemistry, to know how each other operates, to know what each other looks for in the cars and how they look for the setups to be set up and built. Driver comfort, spotter communication, all of that stuff that you kind of figure out through preseason testing, through shop visits, all the normal stuff that we can't do right now. And it's going to be really interesting to see, especially with COVID kind of limiting the amount of interaction we can have with each other, how that's going to, stunt the growth of chemistry between Matt Kenseth and his brand new crew. And also for Matt Kenseth as a driver, he's not only not been in one of these cup cars for over a year, he's never been behind the wheel of a Chevy, let alone a Camaro, a brand that's only been on the track for a few years now. So that's going to be completely different than anything he's ever driven before, because he's not driven a Chevrolet product since 1999 in the Busch series. So that's going to be steep learning curve right there in and of itself. So we're definitely going to be keeping an eye on that Wisconsin driver. But honestly, as an early 2000s NASCAR fan, growing up, you heard names like Dale Jr., Jeff Gordon, but the supporting cast of superstars was always guys like Ryan Newman and Matt Kenseth. And so seeing these two veteran drivers, they may have been down, but they are not out. They've got strong teams. They've now got championship waivers. And if cards fall right, we may be able to see them get that one last hurrah as their careers in the going twilight. So from the inner childhood fan in me, I'm super excited for that in and of itself.
It truly is an interesting thing that we're going to see, because first off, this whole season has started off so weird with the whole starting with Daytona, you know, with Newman having his accident, everyone unsure what's going on, everything, and then, you know, later on that night of the 500, we found out, yeah, he is alive, he's doing well, and less than 48 hours later, he legitimately walks out under his own power to leave the hospital. Incredible, and something we never thought we'd see. But it's going to be interesting to see what that's going to affect him mentally wise. I don't mean like, you know, it hurt his brain or anything, but it's just, is he still going to be his rocket man self? Is he still going to be the guy that pushes it to the limit? I think he will be, but there's going to be some instance. A great example will be Talladega and Daytona, those super speedway, you know, pack races. If he's up in front, is he going to have an issue, or is something going to pop up that he's going to be like, oh man, I remember something, and is that going to affect him? I think, and I really hope it doesn't, because he is such a fantastic racer. And it's not like he hasn't won those events either. He is a Daytona 500 champion for Roger Penske. And it's incredible to not just think about that he's won there, but all of his accomplishments over the years, from racing at Eldora, for instance, in the truck series for Jordan Anderson, and, you know, running Xfinity part-time, and also doing stuff like recently the Prelude to the Dream from 2007. If you don't know what that is, that's an invitational that Tony Stewart put on at Eldora for a bunch of cup drivers, some drag racers, and a bunch of other people to come have an exhibition race at Eldora before the Dream, one of the biggest dirt racing events ever happened. And it's cool because Newman was there. He brought his own car where everyone else bought cars from people. So it's going to be interesting to see what he's going to be, how he's going to be, first off, in the car. Is he going to lose any speed or feel like something has changed? But also, is he going to be able to compete? Now, Kenseth, Matt, is going to be a bigger hurdle, like you said, because of the fact that, A, he's never ran with Chip Ganassi Racing. You know, it's not like they're not friends or anything, but it's something that it never came to fruition. It never was a thing that, hey, Matt Kenseth, it never was a rumor that, hey, Matt Kenseth's going to Jip. No, it never happened. It never was a rumor or anything. So it's one of these things where he's going to have a new team with great cars, but it's that thing of fitting into the groove of buckling back up into a cup car, having a different spotter than when you last ran, and even having a different, not just a crew chief, but a different pit crew. You know, there's more than likely what's going to happen is, and what has been happening, is that Matt's been either flying into the Charlotte area, or has been doing a bunch of Skype calls or Zoom calls with everyone that he's going to be working with, from the pit crew to the crew chief to Jip to the spotter, and work out a bunch of stuff. So it's one thing, I think, in all honesty, that's going to be one of the biggest hurdles we see for any driver for the rest of the year, is seeing Matt Kenseth in the Jip Ganassi 42.
Oh, yeah, no, and it's interesting you bring up Talladega, because while we still have a lot of question marks going on in the world, and there's still a lot of uncertainty about will we or won't we go back to racing, there's still a whole world of virtual racing going on in the background right behind us, and it even brought us to Talladega Super Speedway this last weekend, one of those famous tracks you had mentioned. And so let's go right over there to the virtual Alabama Speedway, where we had quite a weekend of racing, everything from their support race on Saturday, which features a lot of the Xfinity and Truck Series drivers, to, of course, the main Pro Invitational event. So it was the Geico 70 at virtual Talladega, and Zach, where should we get kicked off?
I think the biggest thing to kick it off with is the fact that Jeff Gordon raced Jeff Gordon, who has who's been retired, yes, he did sub in for Dale Earnhardt Jr. When he had his concussion, but he hasn't raced in a few years, and he comes back, he's like, I'm going to get back in the saddle, all right, but it's going to be virtual iRacing, the inner Gordon fan of me is just like, okay, what? It's a cool thing, because I am a Jeff Gordon fan. I have quite a few diecasts back back home in Illinois that I got to bring here because I miss them. But it is an interesting thing that happened, that we got to see, you know, the man, the myth, the legend, Jeff Gordon, come back to Talladega, a man who's won there numerous times, and see him run his 2004 Pepsi scheme that he ran at a Talladega race. That thing looked badass as the new ZL1 Camaro. I love that thing.
Oh, and that paint scheme is absolutely iconic. If you're not familiar with the race it's famous for, it was the 2004 Aaron's 499 at Talladega Super Speedway. And back then, it was really the field versus Dale Earnhardt Incorporated. From 2001 to 2003, DEI had won five straight Talladega races between Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Mike Waltrip. And then they kicked off the 2004 season by winning the Daytona 500. So going into that Talladega race, the field was like, okay, what do we got to do here to make it so it's not either that bright red number 8 Chevy or the bright blue number 15 Chevy that's going to be taking the hardware today? And the biggest challenge to the DEI stranglehold on Victory Lane was not only Jeff Gordon, but his teammate, Jimmy Johnson, who worked quite well in tandem that afternoon. And they were able to put themselves in position to beat Dale Jr., who had the dominant cars all afternoon. It came down to a late race move where Jeff Gordon had the lead and was able to hold Dale Jr. back long enough before a yellow flag ended the race with only four laps to go. The race was past the point where NASCAR could red flag the event, and so they were at the mercy of whether or not the track would get clean quick enough for a restart, because there was no green-white checkered. This is actually the race that prompted NASCAR to look into the green-white checkered rule because of the fan backlash, because once NASCAR had looked at the video and deemed that number 24, that Pepsi DuPont Chevrolet, the winner, the fans lost their minds. They booed for a consecutive two pace laps at Talladega. And if you're not familiar with that track, two pace laps, I think, is like five whole minutes. So that's 5 minutes of just straight booing. And on the final lap, Jeff Gordon's going through that gigantic tri-oval where the start-finish line is not in the middle like Daytona. It's all the way clear down almost to the entry of turn one. He's slowly making that big-ass arc at 55 miles an hour as fans are pelting his DuPont Chevrolet with beer cans. It's one of the most visceral scenes that has forever imprinted in my memory, because I was about 9 years old, 10 years old at the time, watching this race with my grandma, and we were a family of Earnhardt fans, so we thought it was the funniest thing we'd ever seen. My grandma, I will never forget it. She got the biggest kick out of seeing those beer cans pinging right off the 24 car. In hindsight now, as a mature adult, that's a big no-no. That was probably a very, very irresponsible and dangerous thing, but you hit the nail right on the head. It was so great to see that 24 car because it brought back so many memories, and seeing Jeff Gordon, being able to watch him commentate from inside the booth, race at the same time, it was such a great ticket and treat in and of itself, aside from the race and the action that we got to see on Sunday.
Well, now, Brady, I got to stop you right now. Brady, this business about being a mature adult, you're not going to have any more fun. I'm sorry.
I
gave
it's
that up a long time
here.
Ago. Do what?
It's all downhill from here. I start seeing the grays in the mirror. It's low as me. It's all downhill.
I still hang out with professional wrestlers and drink vodka, man. Come on. It's a great life, you know.
It's all what you make it, right?
That is exactly right. Continue, please. But I had to get on you for that one.
Well, John is right on that. We are never too old to have the passion for what we love. And you already have gray hair and you're younger than me. I don't even have gray hair. What is going on? But that is the thing. Like this, you know, Talladega is such an iconic racetrack and it's had a controversial start. I actually watched the video today about, you know, the Talladega 1969 Talladega race. And if you know a guy named Slapshoes on YouTube, he made an incredible video. Go check it out. He does a great, you know, thing explaining it. essentially there's a lot of controversy behind it, behind tires and behind this and that. So it's one of those things where the history starts with controversy and it just keeps moving. And there's been a lot of that. One big one was actually at Talladega. Regan Smith driving the 01 technically won a race there, but NASCAR gave it to Tony Stewart because he crossed the double yellow line. And something very interesting, if you watched it this weekend, Regan Smith that was at home, he didn't travel out to go talk to a driver. He was at home in his sim rig and he had the two yellow lines. And there's a little skit that he did talk about, you can't pass the yellow line, blah, blah, blah. And his son comes in and is like, no yellow line. And then he shoots him away and he comes like, no yellow line. He goes, he does this thing like, wait, no yellow line? No yellow line. He gets off his sim rig. He pulls the table. It's like, no yellow line. Boys, have at it. Pass anywhere. Do whatever. And you know what that means? I've won that race. Let me go get the trophy. And he walks off. It is one of the funniest things I saw for the pre-race. And, you know, having Jeff Gordon in there and him and Clint Bowyer in the same room, they didn't have they didn't share a camera, but they did share a room. And it was funny because they would be going back and forth and there was no lag from the team speak that they were using in the it was one of the funniest things. And I love this entire, you know, I love everything about this because this has given us the you know, some people like me, I've really enjoyed watching these races because it's the fun of it. It's that spirit of, you know, coming together still, even in this time of, you know, not darkness, but this time of uncertainty. And, you know, drivers are having fun with it. If you looked at Landon Castle, he the sponsor Blue Moo, you know, is splattered all over his stuff. Ty Dillon is another one. He's sponsored by Geico, and he has, you know, Geico stuff from hats to lizards just about everywhere. It's one of the funniest things to see these drivers having fun with it, but also having, a little bit of competition with it. It actually reminded me of, again, going back to the Prelude, which, Brady, I'll send you that race on YouTube because it is a great – it's the best 4 hours of dirt racing I've seen because it has everything from heartfelt moments talking about the Richard – the Petties and the what is that camp that they have? The the what?
Victory Junction.
Yeah, the Victory Junction, having that and, you know – But Clint Bowyer made a great line, and he could have said it this weekend. He said, man, I thought this was just for fun. And, man, Brady, I want your opinion because I know we kind of have different opinions about it. You know, I'm really enjoying it because it's still giving us some competition, some fun, something to look forward to. You enjoyed the beginning of everything with the iRacing, right?
Correct. No, I was on board with it from the beginning, but – as you're alluding to, I've kind of – my interest in Wayne definitely in the last few weeks. I didn't even watch the Richmond race a couple weeks ago. I feel like I got burnt out on it pretty quick.
Yeah, and you know, it's something that – and me and Brady talked a little about it earlier. You know, it's not everyone's cup of tea. You know, it was one of these things that was really interesting, really cool. And then not NASCAR, but – you know, the Shankstein body kind of changed some things up, which is fine. It happens. But, you know, it's one of those things where I'm enjoying it because I am one of those diehard race fans, just like Brady. But me and him have it. He has it more, I feel. He wants to see the cars back at the track. He wants to be able to go to the Iowa Speedway, our home track, to go see a race because we desperately want to hear those motors pounding, the driver doing a burnout, and the speech of like, yeah, I beat him fair and square. He can say I cheated if he won.
Well, and it's more than that for me. I do want to see the cars back in person, but I feel like for me, the tone and just the amount of races has kind of shifted to where I didn't really get going at first. At first, I thought it was just going to be kind of like a fun kind of, you know, pickup thing where they do it, maybe try out different tracks we don't go to, make it kind of interesting. I'm not really sold with, you know, basically sticking to what the 2020 schedule would have been. I totally get it about the sponsors and, you know, what they're trying to do with it. I think it's kind of boring because to me, I was like, well, if I want to go watch a race at Dover, it's not my cup of tea to go watch a simulated race when there's literally five decades of Dover races on YouTube that I can go and watch. But also more than that to me, I don't know, the amount – of virtual raids that we've got inundated with over the last 3 weeks. There seems like every night there's three or four different Twitch streams going. NASCAR's got three different leagues, and I don't know what any of them are, if any of them are official. I know one is the actual league, but I don't know if it's Racing Weekly or what the deal is there. It's super confusing, and I just feel like they oversaturated their own market within a matter of 2 weeks because there's nothing else to do. So I'm feeling a little bit of fatigue from that end. To me, this was the most excited I'd been for an iRacing event since that very first one, and a lot of it had to do with seeing Jeff Gordon being in the race. I still tune in weekly to watch Dale Jr. race. Part of the reason I didn't tune in the Richmond one was confusion over whether or not he was actually going to participate, because earlier in the week they had announced saying that Jr. was going to be a part of it. And I was like, well, that's kind of the only reason I'm tuning in week to week, so I don't think I'll watch this week. But no, it's a bunch of different factors kind of adding up at the end of the day for me to where I'm like, it's not my cup of tea. I didn't really grow up a huge video gamer, so I don't have a lot of affinity for that side, that culture, that medium. It's not really my cup of tea, but I definitely understand why it's a big deal, and I'm glad the sport has it because it's super healthy for exposure and for getting us in front of that key demographic that we're always trying to appeal to.
Well, you know, Brady, it's like when it rains during a Saturday in a televised golf tournament. I mean, what are they supposed to do? Just sit there and talk? We already know what happened up to that point, so they put on a video of an old tournament. And I mean, even though you probably have seen it if you're watching the one now, I mean, it's better than turning to Shock Theater
exactly.
or reruns of ABC's Wide World of Sports. You know, come on, you know.
And I'm glad they've been doing a lot of broadcasts. NBC Sports and Fox Sports, they've been doing a lot of coverage on their sports channels of re-airing races. So I'm glad that at least they're doing the best of both, because if you're an older fan or if you're just a fan like me who doesn't have that affinity for the gaming culture, it's nice to know that they're still offering up options during the week and on YouTube of old races that we can use to satisfy our itch. But as a fan, you know, who just likes to see the sport succeed and grow in healthy ways, I know this is a huge untapped market for the sport. This is getting us in front of the right eyeballs, in front of the right demographic. So from that standpoint, I know it doesn't appeal to me, but I know there's millions of other people that this does appeal to. And I'm glad the sport is doing all it can to try and put us in the mindset and try and keep us relevant in an ever-changing, ever-evolving pop culture universe that really is the social media age.
And just face it, it's better than them doing reruns of Married with Children and Three's Company. You got to admit that, right?
Oh, there's no reason to not admit that. It's definitely way better than that.
Although I don't know, Suzanne Summers looked pretty good, but you know, whatever. Christina Applegate. So maybe I picked the wrong two shows. Nickelodeon.
What?
All right. I'm trying to irritate Brady. I'm trying to irritate him as hard as I can. It's not working.
Oh, trust me. Oh, John, trust me. I know.
Well, is it working?
And I agree with you, Brady.
Okay.
I agree with you that on Brady. I you know, I do wish they would do kind of like maybe some throwback races to North Wilkesboro or even Myrtle Beach or something like that in these Cup cars. That'd be
Myrtle
so
Beach.
Much fun and so cool. Exactly. It'd be so cool.
Come here tomorrow.
To see
Come here tomorrow.
but that I agree with you on that, Brady, because we do, you know, are they oversaturating a little bit? We have, you know, the iRacing league that Coca-Cola sponsors, that, you know, is a lot of young drivers, including one Zach something from Connecticut, who gave the command for the Homestead race, which was our first race in this. And then they have that the fun little race that is Xfinity Cup trucks. ARCA stuff that they get to come in and run. You know, do I feel like they're oversaturating a little bit? But it's one of these things too, where it's cool that we get to see this and show. Hey, this is something too. We're the only sport that is off, or we're, you know, racing's the only form of entertainment right now that has something going on. You know, yes, it's all simulated or it's all video games. For instance, F1 is doing a bunch of stuff like this. IndyCar now has hopped on the bandwagon. It's amazing to see that we're still able to, in this, perform or not perform, but entertain people with the ability of online virtual racing, all the way from doing stuff on actual TV, like here in the States on Fox, or stuff on the BBC where F1 has been doing some stuff. So the cool thing is that we get to still see a lot of racing going on when no other sports can do anything. There's no MMA, there's no football, there's no basketball, no baseball, no nothing. Everything has been put on hold. In fact, baseball isn't even sure if they're going to start until like July 1st, which is still 2 months away.
Oh, no, and it's definitely keeping racing right where it needs to be in the it's keeping racing right where it needs to be, right in the public perception, right there in the back pocket, so that way if we do go back racing, we're still relevant and there's been events to talk about, including the frantic Geico 70 that ran at Talladega this last Sunday. It came down to the frantic final laps and a restart with three laps remaining that saw a very close finish of a scant 0.037 seconds between first and second place. The winner was Alex Bowman in the number 88 Chevrolet, barely edging out Corey LaJoie, who finished second. Third place finisher, just 0.001 second behind those two, Ryan Preece. So you literally could have thrown a comforter over those three cars and probably could have blanketed all three of them how close they were running. Now, the rest of the top five include Garrett Smithley and Landon Cassel. William Byron came across the line in sixth. That's Alex Bowman's teammate from Hendrick Motorsports and a two-time winner so far this season in the Pro Racing Series. Brendan Poole had an impressive seventh-place finish in the number 15 Chevrolet. Brothers Kyle and Kurt Busch finished eighth and ninth, respectively. And Daniel Suarez managed a top-ten finish in that number 96 Toyota. So it was an exciting afternoon. We saw a bunch of crashes, a bunch of three-wide racing, two-wide racing. Unfortunately, Hall of Famer Jeff Gordon's virtual debut was cut short. He got involved in a couple racing incidents. What was your take on that? I thought it was a pretty exciting race, and really it felt like a Talladega race on any given Sunday, minus a car being caught in a catch fence or two, you know?
Yeah, I was just about to say that. I can't remember a time at Talladega where a car was hung up like laundry, stuck in a catch fence. But yeah, it was definitely one of those. It was definitely a Talladega race. That's the best way to explain it. And the reason I say that is because Talladega has been known for having these incredible, and I do mean this incredible racing action, from having, you know, six cars within, you know, that could be under a blanket, which we saw a few years ago where Clint Bowyer won in the 33 car for RCR, and then having finishes like Brad Keselowski winning, taking out, unfortunately, Carl Edwards on his way to get his first Cup win ever. It definitely felt like we had that Talladega magic, the full throttle, all out, boys have at it. You know, even like, and I'll say it like this too, at Super Speedways, you can have low budget teams finish really well. A great example is Garrett Smithley and Brandon Poole, like you said. Both of them are underfunded teams. They could have done that in real life, finished up there. By the way, that was the first race for Brandon Poole in the Invitational. He had not made a start all season in the Invitational until today, or until then.
And what a debut it was. And it kind of also kind of tying up some loose ends with this race. Jeff Gordon ultimately finished 38th after his two wrecks. He came into this race tied with Dale Earnhardt Jr. amongst active winners with six Talladega wins in real life. Jr. also did not have a good Sunday as he got clutched in two multi-car wrecks and finished 30th overall. The two leadingest drivers of the afternoon, John Hunter Nemechek and Brad Keselowski, both led 11 laps each. They had mixed results, with Keselowski ultimately settling for a 19th place finish and John Hunter Nemechek settling for 25th when the day was done. Pit strategy certainly worked in Alex Bowman's favor. That's what eventually led him to his first win in this Pro Racing Invitational Series. And this is not his first win of 2020. Bowman was one of the three winners that picked up a checkered flag before our racing season was put on hold, him picking up the checkered flag at California Speedway, the third event of the season. So it was really good for that team, especially with their new sponsor, Chevy Goods, on the quarter panels. It was good to get them that exposure because they've not had a lot of races to do so far in 2020. And honestly, like I said, it may not be my cup of tea, but I'm glad it's there, keeping it in our minds, keeping it on the forefront of our thoughts as we're trying to find new ways to entertain ourselves in quarantine. Which, speaking of, we found, I think, probably one of the best ways in my books of keeping entertained and keeping racing at the forefront. And that's our Racing Rewind that we've been doing every week, Zach. And we picked a pretty special race this week, the 1998 Daytona 500. So kind of set us up the stage why we picked this race and what are some of the fun standouts about this race that makes it so beloved in NASCAR history.
The year 1998, the drivers all over the board, young, old. We have the young gun, Jeff Gordon, wanting to win again. We're having the old timers, Dale Jarrett, Bobby Labonte, Terry Labonte, Kyle Petty. A lot of them been racing for a long time. A lot of them wanting to win the Daytona 500. Some getting it again. But instead, we had the Intimidator on his 20th try ever to win at the Daytona 500. It had eluded him for many of years, from a blown engine to a blown tire, a flip, a bird going through the radiator. It was everything and anything you could think of happened to Dale. And on the 20th running of his of the Daytona 500 for him, he finally gets the checkered flag at the end of the day. It wasn't a dream. It wasn't anything but special. And I'll tell you this, if you were a not just a racing fan, but if you were a fan that knew, or if you were a person that knew what NASCAR was and knew the name Earnhardt, you knew how special that day was.
And honestly, there's been a lot of reporting in the years that have passed since that legendary win about just how focused Earnhardt was on this race, about how much he wanted to put everything he had on the line. Coming into the 1998 season, he was coming off for the very first time in his career a winless season. The entire 1997 campaign, even though he picked up 4 second-place finishes and a pretty respectable 5th-place finish in the point standings, the Intimidator did not find victory lane in his number 3 Chevrolet. So that was some extra motivation as he was seeking out that very first elusive win in NASCAR Super Bowl. And he was a man driving possessed. If you watched that race, there was no one and no thing, nothing that was going to get between him and victory lane. He led 107 laps, was constantly within the top 5. I don't think he ever fell out of the top 10 all race long, minus pit stops. He was just constantly working, just in the shadows, pouncing on any moment that came his way, and just being there ever in the thick. And that's ultimately what led him into victory lane that day. It was a relatively calm afternoon with only 3 caution flags flying, the first one of which on lap 126, over halfway through the event 500 miles. It came out for the number 22 cutting a tire off of turn 3. The race resumed on lap 129, but it was slowed again on lap 174 for an accident in the backstretch involving the number 43 and number 77 machines. This set up the final pit stop, where Dale Earnhardt and crew were able to keep that number 3 Chevrolet in the lead. They were able to put on quick service and get him out in front of the Penske duo of Jeremy Mayfield and Rusty Wallace, who had been in his back bumper heading into pit lane and into that caution flag period. And from there, he was able to keep everyone at bay, work the lap traffic, and work his way successfully to what ended up being the final yellow flag of the event. It came out on lap 199, right as they were going into to get the white flag, again involving the number 43, and this time also the number 9. They spun in the backstretch, which led Dale Earnhardt Sr. leading Bobby Labonte and Jeremy Mayfield into turn 3 and 4, able to use the lap car of Rick Mast as a pick to keep his number 3 Chevrolet planted firmly in front to take the white flag and yellow flag and eventually go under the pace lap at the slower reduced speed to take the checkered flag. And one of the most iconic moments ever in sports, arguably, but definitely the most iconic moment in motorsport.
That is for sure. And that list of drivers that are on there, well, first off, if you look at the list of drivers that didn't make it on there, it was 58 cars qualifying for a 43-car field, and you had drivers like Kenny Wallace, David Green, Jeff Green, Norm Benning, which was, I've worked for Norm for a few times, and it still surprised me that he tried to run some races in the Cup Series. Mark Grissom, Johnny Benson Jr., Todd Bodine, there's quite a few cars that didn't qualify. But then you look at the cars that are on there that made the race and was racing. Obviously, Jeff Gordon and Dale Earnhardt are on there. You said Rusty Wallace, Jeremy Mayfield, Ken Schrader, who, still races to this day, not in NASCAR per se, but in dirt stuff. He actually goes through the Midwest a lot. Him and Kenny Schrader do a lot of racing, Kenny Wallace, I'm sorry, do a lot of racing together and have fun with each other. You have drivers like John Andretti, Lake Speed, Jimmy Spencer running out there. And you have Rick Mast, a legend, a fantastic racer. Sterling Marlin, a man who's won the race before. Jeffrey Bodine, who's also won there. Now Jared, Dick Trickle, Derek Cope, Dave Marcus, and Mark Martin. There's so many great drivers on there that this race, there's no drivers right now that ran in this that run today ran in that in Cup Series or ran in the Daytona 500. Then it's astonishing to see what you know what that 22 years has done.
Well, and you brought up an interesting point when you kind of teased us into this 1998 500. It was really at the most pivotal turning point in modern NASCAR racing. It was really at the true changing of the guard moment. Jeff Gordon had been on the scene for a few years. Everyone saw that what he had been able to do with such limited experience and just raw all-out talent and his youth and vibrance and what it did for the Hendrick Motorsports team. And so the latter part of the 90s was really focused on each team trying to find their Jeff Gordon, try to find their golden ticket to lead it into the millennium. And really, you were seeing a bunch of stars kind of in the twilight of the careers, drivers like Mark Martin and Rusty Wallace, drivers who were really good in the late 90s but stumbled early on in the early 2000s and eventually would fade into the sunset. Drivers like the Labonte brothers. Bobby was just a couple years shy of winning his first NASCAR championship before eventually fading out of, into obscurity throughout the, late, the early part of the 2000s. Terry Labonte was coming off the championship just a few seasons ago, and he too would kind of steadily fade into the background as the 2000s roll on. So it was a very interesting, pivotal moment where the drivers of the 80s and 90s, the drivers that really carried the sport onto their shoulder into the national spotlight, that were kind of just honestly in their final acts of their career, drivers that would only maybe be behind the wheel for a few more seasons, like Darrell Waltrip, Rick Mask, Dick Trickle, just prominent names that you would hear all the time competing for championships and wins week out and week in when NASCAR was rising to its popularity. They were kind of on their swan song and their farewell tours by this point. And so that's also where this 1998 500 really stands out in NASCAR history, because it was just truly a pivotal time for names like Kenseth, Earnhardt Jr., Stewart, Newman, Kane, drivers that were coming up through the lower divisions at this time were fighting in ASA, fighting in the Busch Series, or even the Truck Series. So they weren't quite yet to that Cup Series division, and this was kind of right before that big change happened in 1999 and 2000 and on through as the new millennium took hold.
And that is a big thing is, you know, these – it's just so spectacular to see, you know, not just these names come through, but also just some legendary people who are still active in the sport. They may not be racing in the Cup Series and they may not be, you know, at the track, but you still have people – you know, like Gordon, who's an announcer. You have the Labonte brothers. Bobby Labonte right now is running in the an iPro Invitational for Joe Gibbs Racing, a team that he's ran for and won at Daytona 500 or 2-4. You got Joe Nemechek, who actually still does run. He doesn't run competitively, and he doesn't run all the time, but he still runs in the NASCAR Xfinity and the Truck Series. And I think of it this way. I don't even think his son Joe or John was born yet when this race happened in 98.
I'd have to look that one up. It might have been real close, but it's definitely a time capsule. Plus, it was in the final years of CBS broadcasting of NASCAR races. That deal would expire 2 years later in 2000. And just what an iconic broadcast from Ken Squire kind of showing up in random parts, providing great color commentary and points when it needed it. And then Mike Joy, at the prime of his career, being the lead broadcaster, guiding us through this epic voyage to what eventually became the most ultimate payoff with this Earnhardt Sr. victory. He had the great call coming off of turn four, beautifully painting the picture as Earnhardt finally shed that monkey off his back and raced into racing eternity. And then no one could forever forget that call when almost everyone was moved to tears when he noticed for the first time how the receiving line had kind of just formed on pit lane, and every man and every crew member that was down there on that pit road had lined up to shake the man of the Intimidator to congratulate him on winning finally in the 500 in his 20th attempt. It was just the most beautifully well-executed, put-together race, and it truly epitomizes racing in the late 90s. If you look at the cars especially, everything about them screamed why the 90s was so successful. It wasn't just sponsors adorning the hood of these cars back then. The sponsors and the cars kind of became one. They were these bold, you know, simple, iconic looks. If you look especially at the number 2 and the 12, I really loved how those cars were painted the exact same. and they were the perfect bases for their sponsor logos to just absolutely pop. The Miller on the hood of the number two and the big iconic Pegasus on the side of the number 12 for the Mobil 1 sponsorship. Even though the cars looked almost identical, those two defining features made those schemes uniquely their own, but also gave, you know, Roger Penske that kind of that semblance and made those cars really look like a unit on the track when they were working together. So that stood out to me. Obviously, the iconic rainbow car of Jeff Gordon, even though it was a bright and flashy car, the overall design is super simple, and that's what I think what made the 90s scheme so successful and so iconic was that it blended the gaudiness of just having these super huge sponsor logos set atop some really just simple, nice color schemes that really beautifully accentuated the color palette of each individual sponsor. That's why it looks like the Goodrich car, the STP car, the old Interstate Batteries car, that Mobil 1 car I was talking about, Ken Schrader's Skull Bandit car. They were all simple. They had just clean lines and just big, gaudy sponsor logos that just paired beautifully together. And honestly, to me, that is poetry and artistry in motion. And I was just, that was what I spent a majority of the 2.5 hours during that race doing, was just admiring just how well those iconic looks of the 90s just really popped in that CBS broadcast.
That is true. And you know, that, and this is a time too, before, you know, HD, 1080p, all that, this was the old school. And if you could make your car pop, you know, sponsor-wise, color-wise, you would get the attention from not just the fans, but the people watching on TV. They may not be active NASCAR fans, but they'll see, like, oh, this company, like, for instance, Lake Speed, he had the Infinite Spam car. It was bright. It was blue with bright yellow. It was a fantastic-looking car. And people would look like, oh, Spam sponsors a NASCAR. Oh, look at that car. That looks cool. I want some Spam now. You know, it's one of those things where the cars look amazing, and with that came some amazing race action and came some legendary drivers out of it. You know, obviously Gordon, obviously Earnhardt, obviously the Labonte brothers. But it's just one of those things where not just the amazing-looking cars, but the talent and the sheer of, you know, the wanting, what of wanting that, the wanting of the win, the wanting to be up front to get that win and the wanting to get a championship. You know, if you look at the top five of that of the race, all those except Ken Schrader, and I don't think Jeremy Mayfield ever got a championship, but, like, you know, Earnhardt, Labonte, and Wallace are champions in the sports. And even if you go through the top 10, again, you have some people who are championship drivers, and it's incredible to see what the, you know, what the future had been at there, the present what it had been, and the future of what it could be and would be.
Exactly. And kind of looking at the season in retrospect, obviously Earnhardt left this race as a championship point leader. He had a lot of momentum. He had a pretty solid 97 campaign, no wins aside. And so with this Daytona 500 win in hand, Earnhardt really thought this was his chance at an eighth championship. Unfortunately, the season didn't go his way. That was his only win that year. He was able to net five top fives and 13 top tens en route to an eighth-place finish overall in the 98 standings. So not exactly what the Intimidator had in mind, a bit of a slip in performance that season. And ultimately, the championship would go to Jeff Gordon, winning his second consecutive championship with on the strength of 13 wins, 26 top fives, and 28 top tens out of 33 races. You want to talk about domination, that is Jeff Gordon, 97 to 98. The man was just absolutely unstoppable putting up numbers like that. So really, really impressive stats there for a Gordon campaign. Martin came home that championship year in second on the strength of 7 wins, 22 top fives, and 26 top tens. Dale Jarrett, in the prime of his career, came home third in the championship on the strength of 3 wins, 19 top fives, and 22 top tens. Rusty Wallace came home fourth in that championship with 1 win, 15 top tens, and 15 top fives, and 21 top tens. And Jeff Burton, a driver who was really starting to show some muscle in the 90s, and I could not help but admire the beauty of that X-Side black and purple 99 machine during that 98 500 race. He came home fifth in the point standings with 2 wins, 18 top fives, and 23 top tens. So 98 was a very special time for NASCAR, but the hype could not have been any better. and you could see it in every aspect of the sport. Daytona was really improving its facilities. The 500 victory lane was starting to really come into something special. It was just a really special afternoon. And honestly, I got to eat my words a little bit. You and I talked about this a little bit. The race, while I maintain, is not one of the more exciting races I've seen at Daytona, especially compared to some of the races I was seeing in the 80s. But it was not the snoring the boring snooze fest that I kind of touted it to be at last week's show. So I do have to kind of eat my words there a little bit. The race was actually pretty exciting. We saw pretty standard two-wide racing at the beginning of the race, quite a bit of three-wide racing, even though the pack would get spread out to see a lot of single file around the bottom. It didn't take a whole lot for a group to form to catch them. So we really didn't see a whole lot of breakaways and a whole lot of single file racing. The drivers were able to get good runs. The car sucked up well. They were able to side draft pretty well. So overall, it was a fairly entertaining race, even though there was only the three caution periods and no major carnage or major accidents. So I feel like I had to kind of eat my words a little bit from last week and say that actually the race wasn't as bad as I remembered it being.
I'll just say it now. But yeah, I do, you know, this is one of those races. It's not just a great story behind it. You know, it's not just, you know, Earnhardt finally gets redemption at Daytona. It's one of those that it really, it shows what the season was going to be, how hard teams work and everything. And 98 is one of those seasons where, you know, Gordon was dominating, but there was a big scandal at one point. I don't know if you've ever seen it or heard about it, called Tiregate, where Jack Roush and Mark Martin accused Jeff Gordon and Hendrick Motorsports of using an additive on tires that they brought to the track to make them last longer. Do you know about anything about that?
Well, I've heard a couple of these stories. I know that they were looking at a lot of things that the Gordon team were quote-unquote innovating, not cheating, innovating at the time, including some pretty infamous chassis around that era. But I don't think I heard about the tire additive story in particular.
So, again, I'm going to reference the guy Slap Shoes on YouTube. He did a fantastic story about this. But essentially, you know, Gordon was unbeatable in 98. You know, he didn't show there at Daytona, obviously. He did have a great run there. Do not get me wrong. I do want to say that. Do not get me wrong. He had a great run there, led some laps, finished 16th. But the rest of the season, 13 wins. Okay, that is almost half at that point of the races they ran. That's incredible. And, you know, back then, teams, if they didn't use tires during a race, let's say it was a long, like Daytona, for example, it was a long race, they didn't get as many cautions, so they didn't do as many pit stops, they have, you know, two or three sets left over, teams could take them to the shop and bring them to races at similar tracks. So, you know, they could have taken a set from Daytona in for the 500 and brought it to July for the Coca-Cola 600 or the Coca-Cola 400 and vice versa, taking tires from like Martinsville to Bristol and so on and so forth. Well, after a race at New Hampshire where Gordon took two tires where everyone else took four, he somehow was able to manage using, you know, right side tires for over 100 laps, I believe, without a puncture or anything, and be able to win the race. Well, obviously, that raised some questions and concern with Jack Roush because Mark Martin had been dominant throughout the season. He got a letter in the mail with a little vial that said this is what they're using and referred to Jeff Gordon and his team putting additives on the tires that they took back to the shop. So what that did essentially was give them a bonus. It gave them longer-lasting tires, or so what the letter said. There was no guarantee that this was true. After another race, Jack Roush and Mark Martin protested, saying they're cheating, they're doing this and this, they're putting this additive in. And even in the letter, it said that the additive is very hard to detect. So they gave the additive, and NASCAR confiscated a lot of tires to do some tests on to see if they had been cheating or not. At the end of the season, NASCAR said, we haven't found anything, they're not cheating, blah, blah, blah. Gordon still won the championship. And to this day, there's still people, if you ask around, like Jack Roush at Roush Fenway, that say, oh, yeah, he cheated, blah, blah, blah. There's people at Hendrick say no, and then there's people all over the board that have mixed opinions or are unsure.
It's one of those mysteries. It's kind of like the traction control that they were accused of having in the early 2000s or the way they were skewing cars in the later 2000s and early 2010s. just various ways that NASCAR engineers have found colorful ways to paint outside the lines. It's not necessarily that they're breaking rules, but it's the air bud rule, you know? There's no rule stating that a dog can't play basketball, so, you know, until someone says we can't do it, there's a little bit of gray area to work in. Obviously, those pages have been filled in a little bit more clear in black and white throughout the years due to innovations like that, so we may never know if there's any truth to that, but you bring up a great point. That is something that is a very big part of our sport, and it was really prevalent back in the 90s when the cars were becoming more and more equal, and you were looking for anything and everything to give your team the upper edge on the competition.
And you know, there's controversy like that throughout the years. And one thing that this did do, though, was then mandate NASCAR then mandated you're not allowed to take tires back. If you buy them at the track, you give them to, you know, you give them back to Goodyear, blah, blah, blah. There was this, no, you can take tires back to your shop. What happens? You use the tires, you don't use the tires, you don't take them. So there was a rule change from it. And, I mean, how many times have we had a driver who, quote, unquote, broke a non-essential rule or something that wasn't a rule and got, you know, then a change of some sort? For instance, one that I know of that I'm not going to mention the driver name or anything because I want some people to do some research and I'll make this a challenge to people. Back in the early days, this is back in the 50s or 60s, I believe. I can't recall it off the top of my head the year. But a well-known racer put a basketball in his gas tank. The reason being, he could put more fuel into it. Why did he do it, though, you may add, because it sounds like it's taking up more space. Well, he put a bigger gas tank in his vehicle, but when NASCAR tested to see how much it would hold, they would get that it was in compliance. He would then deflate the basketball and be able to add in about 2 to 3 more gallons of fuel. If anyone on our Facebook that or listens to this can message me the winner for that, I have a special little gift for you to give you, whether it's whether you want it or not.
That's ingenious. That is really cool.
The business of giving out gifts. So if we heard it one more time here, Zach, you said our clue is what now?
So what driver and what year? Okay, this is the thing. A driver put a basketball in their gas tank. It was fully inflated. Who was he and what year was it? Because the reason he did it was to get more fuel in his tank. He would
And if you've been paying attention to our iRacing broadcast these last few weeks or the Dale Jr. Download, I know this story has come up in the last few weeks on some of the most recent programming. So a very good piece of trivia there, and you heard the man. If you get to our Facebook page with the answer and you're correct, he's got a special prize in store. So make sure you tune in for that.
Now, one thing, too, I want to say right now, we are not eligible. John and Brady are not eligible, and you have until next week's show to get it. If no one claims it, the prize will carry over, and I'll have a new contest, whether it be NASCAR trivia. If it is NASCAR trivia, by the way, it's going to be older stuff. It's not going to be like, who won the Daytona 500 1998? Dale Earnhardt Jr. Dale Earnhardt Sr. You're right. It's not going to be that simple. I'm going to make you work for it because it is always going to be interesting and fun, and that's what I want.
Well,
I got to say, this
is Dr. John. Whoever, since I can't participate in this, whoever wins gets to come down and have a free drink with me, drink of your choice down in Myrtle Beach at one of our places that's open this season. How's that?
There we go. I got a couple of old hats that I really don't have any use for that. I've got some cool NASCAR stuff. Maybe we should do this a weekly thing, and maybe I can throw in a couple there.
All right.
That would be fun for sure. So we still got 10 minutes, and there's something we need to address. So like we said earlier in this broadcast, I know Brady did, there's rumors that the race is going to start essentially 2 weeks. We'll have two more shows from now. Till we go full into possibly racing. And I say possibly because nothing's set in stone. We haven't poured the concrete. We haven't made the gravestone of when this, you know, break for NASCAR is going to end. So with that, we still have two more throwback races. And Brady, I want to ask you, because I have a list wrote down that we had, And I feel like this would be a good time to ask maybe even John, would you rather have our favorite races that we attended or our first ever races we attended? Me and Brady have two different races. Mine is in 2004 and Brady's is in 2012, correct?
We're talking Cup Series. My first Cup race was 2012. My first overall NASCAR race was 2009.
I'm going with Cup races.
And yep, my first Cup race would be 2012.
So, John, would you rather have our favorite or our first? Where our burning passion at being at the track, seeing the big boys, seeing the Cup Series, seeing the Jeff Gordon's and Dale Jr.'s run, or seeing our first races ever, or our favorite
races
ever?
The first race ever, for sure.
Honestly, I gotta agree with that. That's a good choice.
That is. So, Brady's is the 2012 Kansas playoff race. What race was that, Brady?
I believe that was the, if I remember correctly, I don't think it was the Hollywood Casino 400, but I know that's usually around there, but I'll have to look that one up, actually. Not Kansas.
I'm looking up right now for you. But so that will be Brady's. We'll do that this week.
Wait,
that is
the STP, no, the STP was the spring race. It was the Hollywood Casino 400. Okay, I was right. So, yeah, it was the 2012 Hollywood Casino 400. It was the first – one of the first two seasons where Kansas was running two races a year. But the big news story heading into that race was Kansas itself had just underwent a repave. The track had a brand-new surface that had been reconfigured just a little bit to tweak the banking, and we were in for an exciting afternoon of racing for that first race on the repave. Also, it was kind of a sad race. It was the first of two races that Dale Jr. would miss due to concussion-like symptoms he suffered after pretty severe wrecks and a practice crash at Kansas earlier in the fall, and also the big wreck that they were coming off of at Talladega the week prior. So some pretty interesting history was made. A very relevant veteran took the checkered flag. I'll kind of save the teasers on that one. But that was my first race, and I have a lot to talk about now. And so the 2012 Hollywood Casino 400 at the Kansas Motor Speedway.
Now, here's something cool. I've actually attended a race there myself. It wasn't that one. It was actually the SpongeBob 400 in 2014, I believe, or 2015, because that's when Kyle Busch. There we go. Kyle Busch from
Jimmy
the
Johnson.
That's the coming back. Jimmy Johnson? Yeah. Well, no, Kyle Busch, that was the year Kyle Busch wasn't running. Because he broke his legs, and Eric Jones made his debut Cup race there.
Yes, that is correct, and Jimmy Johnson ended up being the winner there.
Which was a lot of fun. So my race is actually the 2004 AUD 400, or AUWD?
UAW Mopar. Diamond Chrysler 400?
Yes, in Las Vegas, Nevada in 2004. I was 10 years old. I have a lot of family in Vegas, so what else would we do? We would fly out to Vegas to watch a race. I actually been to that race a handful of times, and I'm not going to spoil who won that either, not only because I don't remember, but there's no fun in it. But that will be the week after. This week, it will be the Hollywood Casino 400 at Kansas. It is the playoff race for 2012, Brady's first ever Cup race. And give me one good memory, or give me one memory from going to that race that you love to share with everyone.
Well, and I'll probably go a little more in-depth with it next week, but the biggest memory about not only that race, but my first two truck race and nationwide race, now Xfinity Series race, that occurred in 2009, all three of my very first races I ever attended that were NASCAR-sanctioned races were with my dad. My dad was the guy I grew up watching races with. He was the whole reason I became a NASCAR fan to begin with, was because it was something I could connect with him with, I could bond with him with, and talk to him about. And so it was really cool. We had gotten tickets from a mutual friend of ours. They had not only gotten us tickets, but inside field passes as well. So we were all able to go into the infield of the track, walk around, see drivers, take pictures, get a couple autographs, actually go in and see the Cup cars in the garage area being prepped. So that was something that was mind-blowingly awesome for me, being that close to a Cup car just hours before the race. I got to go out on the front stretch of the track and got to take some pictures there. Had really great seats right down in at the exit of turn four, and that's where a lot of action ended up happening that day, and you're going to see that when you watch that race. But that is the thing that's always going to stick out to me, as I may forget who won the race few years down the road in other storylines, but I'll never forget driving down to Kansas with my dad in my little beater 93 Pontiac, not only making it the 8-hour round trip to and from Kansas, but then driving an additional hour from my hometown in Newton up to my college town in Waverly, Iowa, because I was still in college at the time. So it was a busy, busy, busy Sunday, but one of my most treasured memories, because who doesn't love to be able to go spend an entire day with their dad and be able to do that doing something you both love? And that's always something I'll forever treasure about that afternoon.
That is so cool. And that track is an interesting one. I have not only worked there, but seen a race there. God, I got two great stories from Jimmy Johnson scaring the living crap out of me to me getting hit on pit road. Those are stories for another time, though, but I am excited to watch that. It's always Kansas is always a fun race, and especially when it comes to playoffs. They always have some interesting stuff happen, whether it's in 2012 or, Matt Kenseth and Joey Logano getting into it. It's always a fun track to watch. So that is the race for next week. I can't wait now. I'm excited. I'm hoping we have some more news and we have a more concrete idea on when we go racing. I was about to say when and if, but I mean this, when we go racing, because it will happen sometime.
It's going to happen sometime. Definitely, it seems promising that NASCAR has the support from the right people with the right authority and power to greenlight such a show to go forward. Whether or not it's a smart idea, whether or not it's medically advisable, remains to be seen. Like I said, we're probably going to get a probably pretty good read on how successful or how likely this is going to be going forward over the next few days, as states like myself here in Iowa or states down in North Carolina and everywhere around us are starting to ease back restrictions and starting to open up some various places. We'll see if the coast is clear or if this is going to be a bad idea and we need to start reeling things back quickly. So lots to keep a pulse on, and we're going to be keeping our ears to the ground and, you know, nose focused on the story as we're looking to keep you guys fully updated when you tune in next week for the Charlotte launch.
All right, and I'm going to watch Three's Company and Married with Children, and I'll report on those next time, okay?
Can't wait.
That's exactly right.
Did you miss me?
Hey, guys,
with every shot?
Do what? I'm just trying to irrigate Grady as hard as I can, and it's not working. You better be careful now, right? I may bring a guest star on it. All right, guys, thanks a lot. Have a great week. Be safe. Be careful. Come down to Myrtle Beach. Come visit me tomorrow because we're open. All right? Goodbye. Is anyone there?
Bye,
goodbye,
guys.
Grady. Goodbye, Zach.
Bye. Oh, fine. I can take my pants off.
Not on the show, please. Later.